Footsteps of the Messiah in your book on page 348 with the Habakkuk passage, chapter 3, and we're talking about the fiery bolts, the rays coming from the Messiah's hands, and things of that nature. And I want to address the rest of that passage. Let's go to 349. We talked about the curtains of the land of Midian, referring to the Exodus and the Red Sea parting, and now other things are parting like mountains and things of that nature. Okay, so I think we'll start, was Jehovah or was Yahweh displeased? We'll start there. Habakkuk says this, was Yahweh displeased with the rivers? Was your anger against the rivers or your wrath against the sea? That you did ride upon your horses, that's the cherubim, upon your chariots of salvation. Your bow was made quite bare. So God is bearing the bow, getting ready to fire arrows. The arrows refer to the tribulation judgments. The oaths to the tribes were a sure word, the tribes of Israel. Again, this points to the fact that the tribulation is about Israel, Jacob's trouble, not the church's trouble. And so be careful about people saying that their rapture is going to happen midpoint or pre-wrath or post-wrath or whatever about the rapture, because continuing to see these passages, it always refers to Israel, not the church. You know, the tribes. This is my promise to the tribes, the oath that I swore to the tribes. When you see language like that, you have to say, whoa, it's referring to Israel, not the church. The church is not here for that. And I know a lot of people are getting into that, but remember, mid-tribulational pictures of the rapture came in the late 90s. Post-tribulational stuff was earlier than that, but it doesn't make sense when you have Israel and the church there at the same time. None of it makes sense. So anyway, that's a reference to the tribes there. It's important to understand that. You did cleave the earth with rivers. So the idea is how he constructed the earth with rivers, and there's a underground water system that God created. The mountains saw you and were afraid. So it's personifying the earth. The tempest of the waters passed by. The deep uttered its voice and lifted up its hands on high. The sun and the moon stood still in their habitation at the light of your arrows as they went. So referring to that, it's kind of personifying earth and the physical nature of things and putting that into a metaphor. But it's the idea that when he returns, the whole environment stops for him. Everything stops because the Creator is here on the scene and all of creation stands at attention to him. So that's what it's kind of trying to get across. And he goes, at the shining of your glittering spear, it's talking about the judgments that he's bringing with him, you did march through the land in indignation. You did thresh the nations in anger. And that's exactly what we're going to see in just a bit. You went forth for the salvation of what? Your people. What people is he referring to? Israel, yes, thank you. Context, right? For the salvation of your anointed, you wounded the head of the house of the wicked man. That's a direct reference. The salvation of your anointed obviously is the Messiah, right? And Israel. But the idea of you wounded the head out of the house of the wicked man refers to the Antichrist. The wicked man is the Antichrist, and he is the head of that house. The fact that he went after the Antichrist, and you'll see this in just a bit, he decimates him. He goes, laying bare the foundation even unto the neck. The way you translate that in Hebrew is different than what the English is saying, though it's really graphic. The way he handles the Antichrist is he slices him in half. Does that make sense? For he rips them in two. Just as like from the center of his body, he's just ripped in two is the way the Hebrew. So your English doesn't translate it very well, but I guess it's like taking a knife and slicing someone in half. I mean, the literal person is cut in half. Does that make sense? Physically. So Habakkuk gives us that. You'll see this later about the Antichrist and what he does to him, and it's not a pretty scene. But anyway, you did pierce with his own staves the head of his warrior. So the idea is going after the army of the Antichrist, and that's where the blood as high as the horse's bridle is referring to. That it's the armies of the Antichrist that he destroys. They came as a whirlwind to scatter me. Okay, the idea is that they, the armies of Antichrist, came to scatter Israel, to destroy them at Petra, okay, and even Jerusalem. Their rejoicing was to devour the poor secretly. So the idea, they're rejoicing, the Antichrist armies was rejoicing because they were going to wipe out Israel. The poor in this passage in Habakkuk refers to the remnant of Israel, the remnant in Jerusalem and the remnant in Petra. And so the idea is they're going to put them away quietly, secretly, take Israel out, wipe out every Jew on the planet was the goal of the Antichrist. And again, the question comes, why does Satan want to destroy every Jew on the planet? Yeah, so you have the second coming then is predicated on the Jewish believers believing in Messiah. If there is no Jewish believers on the planet, who can plead for his return? So that's what we have learned in the fact that everything rests on Israel's shoulders in their acceptance of him. And so that's why anti-Semitism is at an all-time high in Europe now, and it's coming to America. We're seeing more hate crimes done anti-Semite ways than we've ever seen before. And the church is not helping this out because the church continues to push supersessionism or replacement theology, like we've talked about. So things are not really good right now for the Jews. It's all planned, though. So anyway, the idea is that they tried to wipe out the Jews secretly without the world knowing they want to wipe them out. That's been the plan. It's the final Hitler's final solution, and now it's the Antichrist's final solution. And he goes, "You did tread the sea with your horses and heap the mighty waters. I heard, and my body trembled, my lips quivered at the voice." So the idea is Habakkuk is saying, when I saw what's getting ready to happen to Israel, it freaked me out. It scared me. I trembled. I was afraid. And he goes, "Rottenness or decay enters into my bones, and I tremble in my place. Because," and he explains why, "I must wait quietly for the day of trouble." The day of trouble is the tribulation. So when Habakkuk knows what's getting ready to happen in the future to Israel, it creates a fear in him. And he's scared about it because if you look at all the cataclysmic things that must happen to Israel, it's a nightmare for them. It's an absolute nightmare. Imagine a Holocaust times 10. Imagine instead of Hitler, you have an Antichrist, you know, with supernatural abilities and things of that nature. He sees all this and he says, I'm totally frightened for my people. He goes, "For the coming up of the people that invades us," that's the Antichrist's army. "For though the fig tree shall not flourish, neither shall the fruit be in its vines, the labor of the olive tree shall fail, and the fields shall yield no food. The flock shall be cut off from the fold." All this has to do with the judgments that happen in the Revelation that we're now studying on Sunday mornings of the seals, the trumpets, and the bowl judgments are attacking the planet. God is wiping out the vegetation. He's wiping out the waters. And so nothing can grow. There's no food supply. And so Habakkuk, seeing this, he doesn't see the chronological order that John has given in Revelation, but he sees that all the food supplies are gone. That's why the impetus for taking the Antichrist's mark is so much of a temptation for people, because you will starve to death if you don't take the mark. You can't buy or sell without this mark, right? So along with that comes the fear of famine, because there's no food. And that's what Habakkuk's trying to get across here, what he's saying. And then he says, "The flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls." It could be a reference to the cutting off of the flock of Israel. And the idea that Zechariah points out that 2/3 of Israel will be annihilated because of unbelief, and only 1/3 actually makes it through. So it could be a reference to that, or it just simply could be a reference to the animal life being destroyed at that time. I tend to lean more towards that being a reference to Israel being cut off. "Yet I will rejoice in Yahweh." So he turns it around from fear to joy. I will joy in the Lord, the God of my salvation. Yahweh, the Lord, is my strength, and he makes my feet like a deer's or a hind's feet. That's a deer's feet. And he will make me walk upon the high places. So eventually Habakkuk sees the redemption of Israel after it's all said and done. Okay, so if you turn to the next page, now you're going to see the marching and the threshing of the nations, which comes on in Psalms 18, and continues to give more an elaborate picture of the second coming. And so what you see from the scriptures is there is an abundant supply of second coming passages that give way more description than just Revelation 19. Way more description. Now remember, when we study this from a Jewish perspective, this was what was on the disciples' minds. They knew all these passages. They expected it. So when Jesus doesn't do this, that's what throws them for a loop. Because they didn't understand the first coming, because the rabbis had covered that whole scenario up. So they knew Psalm 18 and all of this, and they're like, he's riding on a donkey, but he's supposed to be riding on a cherub. I don't get that. They, you know, and so the idea of introducing death to them, of the Messiah, was completely a foreign concept to them from what they had learned from the rabbis. So anyway, let's read Psalm 18, and you'll see exactly what we're talking about, what they expected Jesus to do in the first coming, but they obviously had it confused. There went up a smoke out of his nostrils, a fire out of his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down, and thick darkness was under his feet, and he rode upon a cherub and did fly. Now, as you know, that's a horse cherub. As you see in Revelation, it talks about a white horse, but now if you marry this with Psalm 18, it's a cherub that is horse-like. And so that's what he comes riding upon. He goes, yea, he soared above the wings of the wind. He made darkness his hiding place, his pavilion round about him. Darkness of the waters, thick clouds of the skies. At the brightness before him, his thick clouds pass. The idea is the Shekinah glory is accompanying the Lord in the second coming. Hailstones and coals of fire also, he says. Yahweh also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice. Hailstones and coals of fire. And he sent out his arrows and scattered them. That was a reference to what Habakkuk was talking about, that the rays of light were coming out of his hands and the bolts of thunders were coming out of his feet. And that's what kills the Antichrist's army. So it's a veiled reference in Psalm 18 to that, of how he's scattering the armies of Antichrist. And he goes, yea, the lightning's manifold and discomfited them or routed them. Then the channels of water appeared, and the fountains of the world were laid bare. At your rebuke, O Yahweh, at the blast of your breath of your nostrils, he sent from on high, he took me and drew me out of many waters. So the idea is that when Christ touches the earth, not only does it split the mountain, the olives in two, and creates a mountain valley, when he touches the earth, the whole earth goes into convulsions. And apparently, by touching the earth with his feet, the Creator touching the earth again in his glory, it reveals what's under the mantle of the earth, all the water systems that are under it. Because remember, the water systems have been destroyed in the tribulation period. So when Messiah comes back, he actually restores the water systems. And what will happen is it'll start in Jerusalem, a new water system. And that water system will flow from his throne and then will split off. One avenue will split off into the Dead Sea and renew it, and it'll become a living sea. And the other water will go out to the west and hit the Mediterranean. And by doing that, supernaturally, Messiah restores all the water system of the entire planet supernaturally by him touching the earth again. Makes perfect sense. He's the Creator. He's the one who created the world. He created the water system. But remember, he's going to restore Eden, how Eden was, paradise. We will see the earth as it should have been. But you and I have not seen the earth and that original water system because it got corrupted. It not only got corrupted with Adam and Eve, but the flood destroyed most of the water system. It never rained before the flood. So how did the animals and everything get its water? Because God had established an ecosystem where the earth and its canals under the planet watered the ground. And the mists and all the humidity probably from a water canopy made an extremely tropical paradise on this planet. And obviously if the earth had a water canopy, it protected us from radiation, which meant that the animals and the plants grew to extremely large sizes and lived for very long periods of time because of the lack of radiation bombarding our planet. That's why you see the patriarchs living, 900 and something years old. That's why you see the animals that grew to enormous sizes because of increased oxygen levels, and the environment was just ripe for animals to grow very large, like reptiles, like dinosaurs or whatnot. That all is going to come back. So it gets destroyed in the tribulation, but right now you're starting to see Messiah is restoring Eden. And you'll see more of this in the millennium as we study that. Okay, he goes, in the second coming, if you go to the next page, it's going to talk about where Messiah goes first. And in this is Zechariah chapter 12. And we start getting into the nitty-gritty of how he kills the Antichrist and his armies. So the first thing we see is that when he comes out of heaven, here's the first place he goes. He goes, Yahweh also shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem be not magnified above Judah. So the tents is a temporary location. And Jerusalem is a permanent location, so he goes to the tents first, and we know those tents to be in Petra, the temporary location of Israel. And then we know the other group is in Jerusalem. So it's a misnomer to say Jesus returns to Jerusalem, to the Mount of Olives first. He comes to Petra first, but he has not touched the ground there yet. So he's kind of hovering. Okay, so now let's move into the seventh stage, which is the battle from Bozra to the Valley of Jehoshaphat in Jerusalem. And watch how this plays itself out, how he kills the Antichrist and what he does to his armies, okay? So it says in Joel 3, let the nations bestir themselves and come up to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit in judgment of all nations round about. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread ye, for the winepress is full and the vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. So the first casualty then that comes out of this is the Antichrist. That's the first person Messiah kills right on the spot when he comes back, okay? So I don't know if he's in a tank surrounding Petra. I don't know what his location is, but he's by Petra. So Messiah takes him down first. And so it says in Habakkuk 3:13, you wounded the head out of the house of the wicked man. We read this already, laying bare the foundation even to the neck. So the idea is he finds the Antichrist and he splits him in two. Rips them up and down, just right in half, just like that. It's almost anticlimactic what he does to him. Now, the simplicity of how he's killed is described by Paul, and he does the splitting of the Antichrist with the breath of his mouth. By just speaking it, he splits him in two. Then it shall be revealed the lawless one, that's the Antichrist, whom the Lord Jesus shall slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to naught by manifestation of his coming. So it's pretty anticlimactic. He speaks it and splits him. Okay, now, once he's dead, what happens to the Antichrist? Well, interesting enough, Isaiah, in Isaiah 14, gives us a look of his soul descending into Hades and what happens after he is dead physically. We pick up in Isaiah 14, 3 through 11. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall give you rest from your sorrows and from your trouble and from the hard service wherein you were made to serve. They were actually made slaves by the Antichrist. That you shall take up the parable against the king of Babylon. The king of Babylon is the Antichrist, okay? And say, how has the oppressor ceased? The golden city ceased. Yahweh has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers that smote the peoples in wrath, with a continual stroke, that rule the nations in anger with a persecution that none restrains. Talking all about what the Antichrist did. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into singing. Why? Because the Antichrist is dead physically, okay? Yea, the fir trees rejoice at you, and the cedars of Lebanon saying, since you are laid low or killed, no hewer is come up against us. No more anyone will he ever come against them. Now, we move into Sheol, or the place of the dead. Sheol from beneath is moved for you to meet you at your coming. So the idea is Hades is receiving the Antichrist. It stirs up the dead for you, even all the chief ones of the earth. So we're talking about all the notables that were supporting you, the 10 kings and the other leaders of the earth that were for you are receiving you now into hell. It has raised up from their thrones all the kings of the nations that now are dead. All they shall answer and say unto you, are you also become weak as we? Are you become like unto us? Your pomp is brought down to Sheol, and the noise of your vials or harps, the worm or the maggots is spread under you, and worms cover you. So the idea is when his soul enters into hell or Hades or Sheol, the inhabitants of hell say, you were so great on the earth with all your pomp. You were the head of all the nations in the whole entire planet. And yet, you are dead like us. You said you were God, but you're dead like a human being. You're weak like us. And the fact that they're dead and they have no ability to escape. He's in the same place as they are. And they're saying, your body's back on earth, and it's left unburied, and maggots are eating your body. It's a total mockery of him. Even by the inhabitants of hell, the unregenerate, are mocking him. If you move down, you'll see a continuation of Isaiah 14, and it continues, they that see you shall gaze at you. This is in hell, okay? They shall consider you, saying, is this the man that made the earth to tremble, that did shake the kingdoms, that made the world as a wilderness, and overthrew the cities thereof, that let not loose his prisoners to their home. All the kings of the nations, all of them sleep in glory, every one in his own house. But you are cast forth from your sepulcher like an abominable branch clothed with the slain, that are the thrust through with the sword, that go down to the stones of the pit, as a dead body trodden underfoot. You shall not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land, or the earth, basically. You have slain your people. The seed of evildoers shall not be named forever. Prepare ye slaughter for his children, for the iniquity of their fathers, that they rise up and possess the earth, and fill the face of the world with cities. So let's break all of this down. Again, continual mock of him in hell, and they're claiming you're not going to be buried. You don't even have a sepulcher. You're trodden down underfoot. And it's a reference to his body. So as Messiah has sliced the Antichrist's body in two, it lays there in front of the armies. And it goes unburied. And maggots start eating it. And the idea is the soldiers of the Antichrist, as they run from Jesus, are running over his body, trampling it underfoot. It's just nothing but a carcass now, and their leader is now gone. And his body is now being trampled by the armies. It's like nothing. And the idea then also, it says in the end of this, prepare the slaughter for his children for the iniquity of their fathers, that they rise not up and possess the earth and fill the world with cities. That's interesting. That's a Hebraic phrase, a remez, if you want to call it that way. It refers back to several things. I think the misunderstanding of the Antichrist is that some people take Daniel chapter 11 and misapply it because they don't know the Hebrew of it. And it says in Daniel 11 that the Antichrist does not have the desire of women. Okay? That's a Hebraic phrase. The desire of women is Judaism. See, he doesn't have any regards for his father's gods, nor the regard for women. And people take it in a Gentile way and say, oh, he must be a homosexual. No. The desire of women is a Hebraic way of referring to Judaism. What do you mean? Why would that phrase be associated to Judaism? The desire of women. It's related to Genesis chapter 3. What was Eve told? That what? A woman would do what? That a woman would give birth to the Messiah, right? Eve thought it was her, because when she bore Cain, she thought he was the Messiah, and she was wrong, because she says in the text in chapter 4, she says, I've conceived a man, Yahweh. It doesn't say from, knowing your text, it says from the Lord or by the Lord. That's not in the original Hebrew. She flat out says, I've conceived the God-man. That's how it's stated. And the rabbis inserted from the Lord. It's not there in the original text. It's God and Yahweh right there. She knew the Messiah would be the God-man. Okay. She was thoroughly disappointed with Cain, by the way, as any parent would be. And you know how disappointed she was? She named her second kid Abel. Almost forgot. I was going to say Seth, but it's Abel. Do you know what Abel means in Hebrew? Dead serious. It means to be like thoroughly, it's like a, oh. Because she thought Cain, it's all in the names, man. She thought Cain was Messiah. She's disappointed, and she's so disappointed, she shows her disappointment in the naming of Abel. It's like a big sigh, it's like no more, you know, that kind of thing. He's not the one. So anyway, Eve thought that. Okay, so years go by, centuries go by. So follow me on this. Centuries go by, and Satan knows, and the believers know that one day a woman will bear this anointed one. And at that point, it hadn't been funneled into anybody. It could have been any human. Okay? So Satan devises a plan to screw up the genetic lineage of man. And that's why you have Genesis 6. Because he doesn't know which woman it'll be. Right? So it could be all of humanity. It's a woman in humanity. So what does he do? He has the sons of God, the fallen angels, come and cohabitate with women and screw up the genetic line. That's one of the main reasons for Noah's flood, is to destroy hybrids. That's why people don't understand Joshua's conquest, because it happened after that, too, in the land of Canaan. And you'll see, and a lot of people don't understand this, a harem, H-A-R-E-M, harem, given to Joshua over certain cities that possess Anakim or Rephaim or giants of the land. And those are, again, more Nephilim from the cohabitation. And that happens all the way into David's day, because David fights Goliath, and Goliath had four other brothers, right? And so they have to be taken out. They produce their Nephilim. Okay, so, but then when God starts narrowing it down, he narrows it down to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, then Jacob has the 12 tribes, and then he narrows it down to Judah, and then he narrows it down to the line of David. And every time God narrows it down, Satan attacks that line because he knows a woman's in there that's going to produce the Messiah. Okay? So in Judaism, what happened was, and they knew this, as it got funneled down, and they knew what tribe, and they knew the lineage, it's going to be from the lineage of David. The women in that lineage and in that tribe said that perhaps their daughters could one day bear the Messiah. And they suspected, well, once, when they were little girls, they were taught, it might be you, nor it might be you, or it might be you, and they're in their little Sunday school class, that one day you could be the one who bears the Messiah. You're in the line of David, you're from the tribe of Judah, it could be you. And what the term came from, or where the term came from, the desire of Jewish women. was that one of them could bear the Messiah. And obviously, Isaiah funneled it down saying, the girl is going to be virgin, by the way. He adds that to it, which was hinted by Moses in Genesis 3. So the term, the desire of women, is not a reference to homosexuality. It's a reference to Judaism. So the Antichrist doesn't regard the gods of his fathers, whatever religion they are, nor does he regard Judaism either. He's not Jewish. He's a flat-out atheist that eventually takes the worship for himself to become the one God. Okay, they'll bring us back to the Antichrist. This passage is telling you he has a family. Prepare ye the slaughter for his children for the iniquity of their fathers, that they rise not up. Very Middle Eastern. What was David afraid of about Saul? That if he's a competitor against the throne, he's a dead man. And anybody that's a competitor against the throne is a dead man. And so what would they do, Middle Eastern kings do, if a new king came in and took over? They turned around and slaughtered the other old king's family, right? So they didn't have any competitors. That's why Mephibosheth was pleading before David, man, don't kill me, dude. And David, because he didn't, because he made a promise to Jonathan, right? That he wouldn't do that. He would spare Jonathan. And Mephibosheth was from Jonathan, right? So he was spared. But normally, David had every right to slaughter all of Saul's house. But he doesn't. He's very kind and compassionate and gracious to Saul's house. Okay. So what you see here with Messiah is a declaration, kill his family so they don't rise up. It's a Middle Eastern king passage, if you can guess it. Very Hebraic. So it's an indication the Antichrist has a wife and kids, and they are slaughtered too. Just like a Middle Eastern king would do. And why? What does it say in the text? Why is his family slaughtered? I don't want any more rebellion from anybody. I don't want any of his kids rebelling. And then notice what it says that they'll do. What is interesting, why does it throw that out? Do you see what it says there? So they don't do what? Possess the earth and do what? Cities. Take over the earth and build the world with cities. Oh, okay. That's called a remez. That's a hint. It's supposed to throw you backwards, back into Genesis, of something that happened back then. And it's a common theme that's going all through the Bible, and we have to get it. Goes back to Babylon, right? But even goes back further. If you go back to Genesis 5, 6, 7, 8, all the way through to Babylon, when humanity started making cities, they became a problem. And you'll see early on in Genesis that those who follow Yahweh do not dwell in cities. They stay in tents away from the cities. So what you start having in a spiritual term is tent dwelling versus city dwelling. That's a spiritual lesson there. Okay? So I'll give you an example of the difference between the two. When Abraham goes into the promised land, and he's got his nephew with him, Lot, and they separate, where does Lot decide to go? Cities. And Abraham just says, no, I'm not going there, I'm going to stay in the tents. And you saw the problems that Lot got himself into in the cities, right? Okay. So the point about all of this, the spiritual lesson in all of this, is that typically those who gravitate to cities, and don't press this too far, but this is not, you know, because everyone lives in the city now, but typically cities inhabit the grossest sins imaginable. When you clump up humanity together in tight quarters, it seems that sin goes crazy in those quarters. Versus when, like, America was more a rural country, the morality stays pretty good. But you put people into cities like New York, LA, San Francisco, Dallas, Atlanta, Chicago, and what do we have there? Rampant sin, unbridled, untamed, and can't control it, versus someone, a community living in a farming community like Montana or Idaho or something like that. For some reason, humanity, when it gets clumped up, can't control themselves. You have other influences coming in, and I think it goes to this principle that Paul used, that bad company corrupts good character. And then when you're clumped up in a city, you're next to all kinds of crazy people. If you've ever lived in a city, you know what I'm talking about. There's crazies everywhere in a city. But that's what starts happening when you clump up people. It gets deadly. So if you look in Genesis, I think it's chapter 4, they start making cities. And then it goes further on. And then after Noah, they start making cities. There's an old boy that I can't remember his name. I'll have to look in the text. He gives the first gangster rap. Dead serious, man. First gangster rap ever recorded is in the Bible. I'm dead serious, man. You've never seen the gangster, and it's from a guy in a city. Let's see if I can find it. I know I'm going off, but I'm going to make a point here. Genesis 4, by this old boy Lamech. Okay, if you follow it, he's a descendant of Tubal-Cain, from Cain, right? Okay, family. This is the family of Cain, the bad dudes. Okay, so in verse 23, Lamech is rapping to his wives. Okay, so check this out. Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. You just put this in gangster rap, okay? Wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. For I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. That was a song, by the way. That's what they were singing. He was singing to his wives. And he was taking up a defense for Cain. And he says, if you think it's bad to attack him, it's going to be worse to attack me. Yo. So, it's the first gangster rap. There it is. I wanted to tell, you know, Suge Knight and Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre, they're way late on this stuff. Way late. Coolio, he's way late on this stuff. But nonetheless, where are they located? Cities. They are building cities. What did Nimrod do? He built cities. He built Babylon. He built Nineveh. That's what they started doing. Whereas the believers will stay in tents. Okay, if that's boring you, then what's the spiritual application of all this? Why go through all this? Well, the spiritual application is this. You are to treat this planet, this life, as not your home. That you are in temporary dwellings, in a tent, so to speak. And that you're not going to put your roots down and start building your kingdom or cities here. As Abraham lived in a tent, he looked for a city, a heavenly city. Not for anything here. So it's the mindset of, I'm a pilgrim. I'm in a temporary land. This is not my home. And I have a better home somewhere else. I'm only here for my mission. That's where the application comes. That was Abraham's mindset. That should be our mindset. We don't want to sink roots into the ground here, so to speak, and build our own cities, if that makes sense. Okay. I know that's a lot, but the whole point is, that's what it says. And fill the face of the world with what? Cities. Have been a problem ever since Genesis 5. And Babylon is the ultimate bad city. So, the whole point is, I'm going to wipe out his descendants so they can't take over the earth again like they did, and no more cities will exist. What you're going to see in the millennium is a very agrarian society in the millennium. A very agrarian, very, very Edenic, how things should have been. The only city that exists is the one floating above the planet called the New Jerusalem. You just don't see a lot of what you do in the Old Testament as far as them building like Sodom and Gomorrah. That doesn't exist anymore. It's very, very different, very rural. Okay, that's why it says what it says. I know that's a lot, but that's how you interpret those passages. Oh, man. You can overcome it, but it's harder. Let's put it that way. You almost have to be kind of like a Daniel and a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You have to have steel in your spine. You really do. Because if you go into a city and you're some Casper Milquetoast Christian, but there's a lot of those, you'll be overtaken by that. Just by the corruption of being around that so close to you. 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 So close to you.